This is an ABC podcast.
Welcome to PM, I'm Samantha Donovan. Tonight, the pain of high petrol prices. Is there any relief in sight for motorists and businesses? Also, frantic scenes at our airports as school holidays begin. What's causing the chaos, and will airlines ever get back to the way they were before the pandemic?
Well, for 2 years, we've been sort of locked down, but people have now done their road travelling and now they want to go and have a different sort of holiday and go back to their beach and sunshine holidays.
And with Victoria just months away from the state election, four senior ministers have quit the Andrews government. Well, petrol prices are certainly hitting record highs across the globe, fuelled by economic conditions and Russia's war in Ukraine. And they're putting extraordinary pressure on consumers and business. Australian drivers are paying more than $2 a litre, even after the fuel excise was halved in March. Economists are warning things will only get worse. So just how expensive will petrol get, and could it send inflation higher? Kevin Coote reports.
Running a business seems to be getting more expensive by the day for David Palmieri, and it's at the petrol bowser where the Melbourne florist is feeling the pain the most.
Today was a record, actually. It was $180. So I thought that's I haven't seen that sort of number before. That was the highest I've ever seen. Now we're looking at $2. I think it was $2.35 I paid this afternoon. So it's considerably higher, obviously.
It's all because of rising oil prices, driven in large part by the war in Ukraine and oil sanctions on Russia. Petrol's now more than $2 Australian a litre, even with a halving of the fuel excise to 22 cents a litre, a measure brought in by the former Morrison government in March. As a retail florist, David Palmieri's constantly on the road doing deliveries across Melbourne's northwestern suburbs and has so far resisted pushing up his fees to cover the growing petrol bill.
It's a cost of business, I guess. It's not much you can do about it at the moment. Transportation is huge. It's been, you know, not only going out of our shop, but also coming in as well. Growers generally aren't obviously located within 2 km of your shop. They're coming from more rural areas, mainly Victoria. So they're transporting goods into the markets where I buy from, and their costs are obviously going up, so they're passing that on through to me. Everyone's fiddling along the line. At the moment, we're absorbing the costs. We haven't changed our delivery fees. We do engage a third-party courier for our sort of, I guess, one-offs and further away sort of deliveries. Those guys have all put a surcharge on.
Some experts are worried the rising petrol prices and businesses ramping up their costs as a result could drive an inflationary spiral. David Byrne is a professor of economics with the University of Melbourne and focuses on energy markets.
So we measure inflation by something called the Consumer Price Index, which is, you know, a basket of goods that affect, you know, kind of your typical Australian. Petrol, of course, is a major part of that basket of goods because we drive around every day. And so it's a big component of it. It's a large part of people's costs. And the large price increases we've seen show up in the rise in CPI, and then inflation's when the CPI starts growing. So it's directly related. It's an important feature of it.
So when it comes to petrol, how long do you think Australians can expect to see prices continue to rise?
Yeah. So I've been asked this a lot. The first thing I'll say is I don't have crystal balls, so I can't predict the future. But what I can say is, you know, looking at the war in Ukraine, I think as long as that is persisting, we should expect to be in a higher price, petrol price sort of regime than we've otherwise expected. And you need to remember, in Australia, we've had the excise tax cut 22 cents per litre. So we're already getting a tax cut, and it'll be interesting to see whether the government brings the tax back in, and we would see another 22 cents per litre added at the bowser already on top of the high prices we see.
The tax on petrol is due to return to 44 cents a litre when the excise cut expires in September, and it's not expected the new Labor government will extend it. But in the United States, there are some signs the high prices could be starting to slow demand. The value of crude oil has dropped as fears of a recession grow. But University of Queensland economics professor John Quiggin doesn't see any price relief in the near future.
I really don't think people's decisions on filling the tank up are driven very much by fears, by worries about recession. I think what we're seeing is we have high prices. They're going to be there for a while. So people start doing things to, yeah, initially, of course, you just pay. When you can see it's going to be around for a while, you start looking at, well, can I take the bus to work? Do I really need to go into work every day? Those kinds of things.
John Quiggan reckons there's little that can be done to rein in petrol prices.
The government can continue to reduce taxes further. They can subsidise it, but the real question is whether we should. And that's also true of the general inflation. Yeah, the inflation really arises from the big amounts of money the government's put out during the lockdown to keep things going. It's really better to accept a once-off increase in the price level than it is to treat this as some kind of disaster that requires, for example, steep increases in interest rates that could generate a recession. We're actually better off riding this out.
And while riding out the higher petrol prices might mean more pain for people like David Palmieri, the retail florist thinks it'd be wise not to keep cutting the fuel excise for some short-term relief.
We've got options. I guess we can sort of say, well, maybe I'll go to an EV vehicle to deliver flowers. I guess we've all got to make a decision of how we're going to absorb the cost, pass the cost on to customers. I prefer seeing an open market where costs are what they are. Everyone's in the same boat and then everyone deals with it the way they have to.
Melbourne florist David Palmieri ending Gavin Coote's report. There have been some chaotic scenes at airports across the country as the school holidays begin. The airlines predict passenger numbers could reach pre-pandemic levels, with travellers keen to get back in the air again. Our reporter Angus Randall is at Sydney Airport, and I spoke to him a short time ago.
It's all reasonably and surprisingly quiet at the moment here in Sydney Qantas Terminal. But it was a very different story in Melbourne and Brisbane, where the school holidays have already begun. We heard reports of lines out of the door at Melbourne Airport before 6 a.m. Here in New South Wales, schools get out next week. So I'm not too sure how I'd feel be standing in the same place in exactly a week's time. It was a real surprise to see that the line's a little smaller than usual. I spoke to some relieved travellers who told me they were preparing for a rush that seemingly is yet to come.
I've just been prepared and got here early each time.
I was very stressed about how many people there'd be.
So where are you headed today?
Toowoomba, so just west of Brisbane.
And did you get here nice and early because you were worried about long delays?
I did, actually. My flight got cancelled this morning, so I've been put on this one this afternoon, so I'm hoping it doesn't get cancelled again.
And how are you feeling about getting back in the air?
It's great. It's finally good to see the country open up.
Angus, where there are long queues, who's to blame for them?
Airlines have certainly been quick to pin some of the blame on the staff shortages at airports, but of course airlines cancelling flights themselves adds an element of chaos to the whole thing. Earlier today, Qantas announced it was cutting its domestic flights by 5% until September, and that's on top of a 10% cut it made in May. That doesn't have a huge amount to do with staff and the security fears, but it certainly does look like it's going to be causing some chaos and some uncertainty around people flying. Despite this, the long lines don't look like they're going to make a difference to travellers themselves. Earlier I spoke with Neil Hansford from the Strategic Aviation Solutions. He's predicting that we'll all brave the security lines anyway, just to get out of our backyard.
Well, for 2 years, we've been sort of locked down, and there's been either regulations or just the nervousness of people not wanting to commit. But people have now done their road travelling, and now they want to go a different sort of holiday and go back to their beach and sunshine holidays.
So, Angus, what do the experts advise us to do to keep the queues moving at airports?
Of course, more staff is really the simple answer. Qantas says it's boosting ground staff by 15% over this school holiday period. But if fuel costs keep rising, the airlines may have to make some unpopular calls when it comes to the way it spends its money. Aviation expert Neil Hansford had some advice for travellers who are looking to get through the security line quickly.
Once you get in line for the security, don't try and get a bottle of water through. Don't try and get your nail clippers through. Just don't bother, because these are the things that not only slow you up, but it slows the whole line up. As it is, they are not going to be able to get sufficient staff in what is a secure environment that has to have a security pass. You don't get these sort of things overnight. So what you can't do about is the recruitment of the high number of people who have to be approved and trained in the security lines.
Neil Hansford from Strategic Aviation Solutions. Angus Randall, our reporter. A major shake-up of Victoria's Labor government is underway after four cabinet ministers announced today they're stepping away from their portfolios and won't contest November's state election. They are the Deputy Premier, James Molino, the Health Minister, Martin Foley, Police Minister, Lisa Neville, and Sports Minister, Martin Pakula. So where does this leave the Andrews government as it tries to convince Victorians it deserves a third term? Richard Willingham is the ABC's state political reporter for Victoria, and I spoke to him earlier. Richard, are you surprised all four ministers have stepped down?
It is surprising that some of them have stepped down. I'm not surprised about others. It was sort of widely rumoured that Martin Pakula and Lisa Neville wouldn't be contesting the election. I think there's a bit more surprise with James Molino and particularly the Health Minister, Martin Foley. But if you look at it this way, though, they've all been in Parliament since before the 2010 election and much further. Some of them were ministers in the Brax government, so that's a long time. And the other thing I think that's happened is that the pressures and the stresses of the COVID pandemic and the government response has burnt these people out. I think particularly the Deputy Premier, James Molino, who had to step up and be the Premier while Daniel Andrews was off on sick leave with a broken back, and then Martin Foley taking over as Health Minister as well. At a time when the government changed the rules that put so much power and the decision-making on restrictions into the Health Minister's hands. So pretty big jobs. And as we're seeing around the world and across industry, there's a big burnout at the moment.
Do you think the resignations will affect Labor's chances of being re-elected in November?
I don't think so. I think obviously the test for these new ministers who will be coming in over the next 5-6 months is, you know, they'll have to deal with all the issues and they have to put their, you know, best foot forward. It's sort of whether voters actually pay attention to this sort of minutia, I don't know. The biggest risk is that it says to the Victorian public that, you know, that these people are burnt out and that they're tired of working in government. Does that mean that the government itself is tired? It can work both ways. It can be seen as, you know, fresh blood, you know, freshening up, or it can be seen as the opposition describe it, as rats, you know, deserting a sinking ship.
Some of the portfolio reshuffles have already been announced. Who's getting what?
So Marianne Thomas, who is the member for Macedon, which is just outside Melbourne, is going to be elevated to the Health Minister. That's probably the biggest job outside the Premier at the moment, given the state of Victoria's health system. It is in crisis. There's sort of spot fires that they have to deal with all the time. And of course, the pandemic isn't over and there's still that to deal with. So Marianne Thomas, she's currently the Agriculture Minister and Minister for Regional Development. So that's a big step up for her. She had previously worked as a Parliamentary Secretary in that space. Natalie Hutchins will take over as Education Minister. A lot of the other ministerial positions will be worked out over the weekend when caucus meets. The other one to keep an eye on is who will become Deputy Premier. The Premier and this coordinating ministers group has nominated Jacinta Allan to become deputy. And that's interesting because normally there is a factional balance between the Premier and the deputy. Daniel Andrews hails from the Socialist Left faction, but so does Jacinta Allan. So that is an area that may really put some noses out of joint amongst the caucus, because the caucus likes to have a say in this, a vote in this.
What's been the opposition's reaction, Richard? Are they sensing a bit of a chance now as they head towards the November poll?
Well, I think one of the things they've really jumped on is the fact that this will be the fourth health minister Victoria's had in 4 years. So given how important the health portfolio is, it is an area that It's the right political attack, and there's obviously political attacks too about, as I mentioned earlier, you know, why are these MPs so-called deserting the government at this time, and they're trying to make it about the fact that Daniel Andrews is a leader that doesn't consult.
Well, with four of his loyal colleagues gone, is there any doubt that Daniel Andrews will lead Labor to the election in November?
There's no doubt. I'm pretty sure he'll be there. The only person that will probably be removing Daniel Andrews is himself. So I think that's more of a question for after the election, if voters return him.
And what do you think the chances are of that?
Oh, at the moment, the incumbent government is odds on to win, but learned a long time ago not to predict these things, Sam.
We did indeed. Richard Willingham is the ABC's state political reporter for Victoria. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. Just a reminder, you can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Still to come, aid is getting through to the victims of the Afghanistan earthquake, but is it enough? to the United States now, and the Congressional Committee investigating the January 6 Capitol Hill riots has heard several US government lawyers threaten to quit as the then President Donald Trump pressured them to overturn the result of the 2020 election. The committee is trying to prove that Trump's attempts to stay in power in the lead up to the riots amounted to illegal conduct. Ronnie Heyman has more.
Recounting persistent badgering from the then-President Donald Trump, three of his appointees testified the president's plan to reverse his loss was what they described as a murder-suicide pact. The president's arsenal of allegations of election fraud were found to be untrue by the Department of Justice. Former Acting Deputy Attorney General Richard Donohue says Mr. Trump called him virtually every day.
These allegations simply had no merit. And I wanted to try to cut through the noise because it was clear to us that there were a lot of people whispering in his ear, feeding him these conspiracy theories and allegations. And I felt that being very blunt in that conversation might help make it clear to the president that these allegations were simply not true.
A witness to the congressional inquiry into the January the 6th insurrection, Mr. Donohue, was joined by fellow Republicans, Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen, and the department's Office of Legal Counsel lead, Stephen Engel. The U.S. Capitol riot is seen by many as an attempted coup. Committee Chairman Congressman Adam Kinzinger is overseeing the inquiry.
You also noted that Mr. Rosen said to Mr. Trump, quote, DOJ can't and won't snap its fingers and change the outcome of the election. How did the president respond to that, sir?
The Department of Justice is a federal agency that enforces U.S. law and is supposed to be independent from the White House. Its independence was severely tested by Donald Trump. Former Acting Deputy Attorney General Richard Donohue.
He responded very quickly and said, essentially, that's not what I'm asking you to do. What I'm just asking you to do is just say it was corrupt and leave the rest to me and the Republican congressman.
The session also heard claims that at least five allies of Mr. Trump, who had supported his attempts to overturn the election, had asked for presidential pardons to protect them from any future prosecutions. Adam Kinzinger aired the allegations during closing statements.
The only reason I know to ask for a pardon is because you think you've committed a crime.
Lecturer in international relations at the University of Melbourne, Dr. Carla Winston, has been following the hearings.
I think it's quite telling. The majority of Republicans who voted against the certification of results would not have needed to apply for a pardon because there's a clause in the Constitution that says if you were just debating actual law and doing your job, you don't need it. The fact that these five Republicans sought pardons means that they went much further than that.
The committee also heard Mr. Trump sought to replace the acting Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen with Jeffrey Clark, a Trump supporter, with the move crushed only when most of the Justice Department leadership threatened to resign en masse if that happened. In an escalation of the inquiry, federal investigators raided Mr. Clark's home before today's hearings. Dr. Carla Winston says the evidence presented at the hearings could have consequences.
I think that this is already leading to a certain number of prosecutions by the Justice Department. Jeffrey Clark had his home raided by the FBI this morning. And so I think a lot of the information that is being presented to us by the January 6th committee is also being passed to the FBI, who are in fact pursuing prosecutions. I don't know that they're going to get the president. I hope they will get some of the other ringleaders of the process.
Dr. Carla Winston, she's an international relations lecturer at the University of Melbourne. Aid has started arriving in the parts of eastern Afghanistan hit by Wednesday's earthquake, but relief organisations say the situation is dire. Whole villages have been reduced to rubble, and with little shelter left, survivors are now enduring heavy rain and freezing temperatures. The death toll stands at around 1,000, with more than 1,600 people injured. Rachel Mealy has more.
As prayers are offered, men carry the dead to makeshift graves. But they're just the bodies that have been found so far. Others search for loved ones in the rubble, digging with their bare hands. It's now been 2 days since the massive quake struck the remote region in eastern Afghanistan. In the village of Akbar, people tell their tales of survival.
It was so scary that no one knew how to evacuate people, he says. There was this big bang, just like a bomb explosion. Its magnitude was very high. Aid has begun arriving by helicopter and truck, but in the face of the unfolding humanitarian crisis, it's nowhere near enough. Mohammed Nassim is managing part of the relief effort for the Red Crescent. This aid is not sufficient. We request the international organisations to help us. If God willing, we will distribute all the aid to needy people. Afghanistan's Taliban government has also issued a rare plea for international help, calling on the US government to release Afghan assets held in US banks. Since American troops withdrew in October last year and the Taliban took over, it's implemented restrictive social policies and suppressed the rights of Afghan women. The United Nations has swung into relief mode, but the UN assistance mission in Afghanistan says the relief needs to couple with rebuilding. Ramiz Alakbarov is the UN's humanitarian coordinator for Afghanistan.
If the economy is not able to recover and grow meaningfully and sustainably, then the Afghan people will face repeated humanitarian crises, potentially spurring mass migration and making conditions ripe for radicalization and renewed armed conflict.
Marianne Horn is from the International Red Cross. She says the relief effort has turned from rescue to recovery.
When a search needs to be called off, and in this case it has been because authorities believe that no more people can be reached.
The Red Cross is doing what it can to access the remote, rugged regions of the three stricken provinces.
Food will need to be supplied. Shelter will need to be supplied. This is a very remote area where there's already been rain, where there's been hail at this time of the year, which is quite surprising. And up to 200,000 people who are there, you know, left to relocate and need emergency assistance. So food, shelter, tents, blankets, clothes, and then also things like protection programs, particularly for women and children who may have been affected, who may have lost their husbands, their families, their loved ones.
Rachel Mealy with that report. The federal government is considering joining Australia up to the international effort to reduce methane emissions by 30% by the end of the decade. The Morrison government refused to sign the global pact at the 2020 Glasgow Climate Summit. Experts say meeting the target would be a big challenge for the agriculture and coal mining sectors, and farmers are worried they'll be singled out. Here's John Daly.
The federal government is considering targeting methane reduction by the end of the decade. It's a move that has the agriculture industry, the nation's biggest emitter of the potent greenhouse gas, quite nervous. Smithfield Cattle Company Chief Executive Andrew Shearer-Smith is worried operations like his will bear most of the cost.
I'm very concerned about what impact something like this would have on our business and on our industry, for sure.
Andrew Shearer-Smith runs two large cattle feedlots in Queensland, holding thousands of cattle. He says he's already looking for ways to cut down methane emissions with feed additives and genetic research, but he doesn't think a mandated target is the answer.
The industry is probably heading in this direction in any event, and as I said, it's doing it it's regulating itself in many respects. So I'd rather see the federal government put money towards all of the research projects that are underway at the moment that will help us contribute to methane reduction, rather than just impose some kind of arbitrary requirement that may or may not be properly thought through.
Agriculture is the biggest methane emitter, largely because of livestock burps and manure, and accounts for roughly half of all of Australia's methane emissions. The other big emissions come from escaped or fugitive methane gas released from mining and gas operations and landfill. Grattan Institute Director of Energy Tony Wood explains why fugitive emissions from resources operations are so hard to manage.
When we disturb that by mining it, that methane can escape from the coal seam. The coal seams are very tiny cracks, you can't even see them, but the gas is held in those cracks. When you mine the coal, it comes out. If you can extract that methane before you mine it, you might have some chance of not, and capture it, you could do something about it. And that's underground coal mining is at least possible. But for open cut coal mining, which is a large part of Australia's activity in coal mining, there's not much you can do about it, basically, because as soon as you open up the ground, the methane escapes to the atmosphere, and that's why it's called fugitive emissions, because it's running away really fast.
Farmer for Climate Action CEO Fiona Davis is worried agriculture will be unfairly singled out by the government under a methane target.
Farmers shouldn't be used as a political football in public debate. We don't want to be used as cover for the gas industry expansion. We think that farmers are already leading the way on methane reductions, and we're just keen to see the gas and coal industry do the same.
Tony Wood says cutting methane in either agriculture or fossil fuel sectors will be really tough, and Australia doesn't yet have the know-how to do it without penalties to production.
In both cases, you can stop doing it. So in coal mining, you can stop mining coal. And of course, we do know that over time, we can move away from mining coal. On the other hand, unless we stop eating beef and lamb, we've got a challenge. We don't really have, at least in the near term, we don't really have clear answers as to how we would even attempt to reduce emissions by this much.
More than 100 other countries have signed up to this international effort to cut methane emissions by 30% by 2030. The former Morrison government withheld support at the Glasgow Climate Summit in 2020 for fear of its impacts on resources and agriculture. A spokesperson for the Resources Minister, Madeleine King, says the Australian government is now actively looking at the methane pledge, acknowledging it was a challenging issue for agriculture and resources industries. The National Farmers Federation backed the former government's decision to not join the pledge. NFF's Charlie Thomas says a backflip needs to be carefully considered in light of existing challenges for food production.
The consequences of rushing a decision like this, rushing into signing up to President Biden's methane pledge, could be calamitous for the farm sector, and not just for the farm sector, but for everyday Australians who rely on the farm sector for the produce they consume every day. And we know that everyday Australians are finding it increasingly difficult to meet the costs of putting food on their table. And if a blunt policy instrument came in that forced us to actually reduce agricultural production in Australia, that's only going to make those challenges harder.
John Daly with that report. Well, to some good news, it seems there's new hope for the survival of Tasmanian devils. A study of their genetics has found that protected populations of the endangered marsupial, currently held in zoos around Australia, are as robust as wild ones. The endangered marsupial's numbers in the wild have plummeted by around 80% since the 1990s because of a contagious facial cancer. Rachel Mealy has more.
It's a little bit of bright news after a few decades of woe for the Tasmanian devil.
I like to think that one day my grandchildren will be able to see devils in the wild and that I helped contribute to it in some small way.
Carolyn Hogg is the co-lead of the Australasian Wildlife Genomics Group at the University of Sydney. She estimates that since the 1990s, Tasmanian devil populations have been reduced by 80%. They've been hit by cars, had their habitats destroyed, and are struggling with a changing climate. But it's a contagious facial cancer that's had the biggest impact.
So Tasmanian devils are inflicted by two infectious clonal cancers. They call them devil facial tumour disease. And the first DFTD was first observed back in 1996 up in a place in the northeast of Tasmania called Wakalina, Mount William National Park. And since that time, we've seen that disease spread south and westwards across pretty much about 90% of the state of Tasmania now, and populations are down by about 80%.
After the illness took hold in Tasmanian devils, scientists took steps to make sure healthy animals were held in captivity or in a protected environment such as Maria Island off the coast of Tasmania to ensure the survival of the species. Now Dr. Hogg and her team have studied that insurance population of Tassie devils to figure out if they could one day be reintroduced to the wild.
So we looked at 31 locations across the state of Tasmania, so it's a whole of range state survey to look at wild genetic diversity, and what we wanted to see was whether or not the insurance population, which consists of about 650 animals, if that is representative of what happens in the wild.
And the result of the study holds promise for the future.
My hope is that one time, you know, we'll get to the point where, you know, we know we're able to manage the disease and the animals in the landscape well enough that we can start to reintroduce animals from the insurance populations. But really, they're in insurance. They're insurance against extinction in the wild because you're not sure what's around the corner.
The research into Tasmanian devils is using molecular genetics and holds important implications for other threatened species like bilbies. But in the meantime, Dr. Hogg is happy to be working with devils.
Devils are pretty magic, though. They're one of the few animals I've worked with that'll just simply sit in your lap and hang out while you're processing them. And they're very chilled out. Most people think they terrifying screams that they, you know, they've seen on YouTube or seen on TV, and they're not. They're actually a very peaceful, I think quite angelic animal.
Dr. Carolyn Hogg from Sydney Uni, Rachel Mealy reporting. That's PM for this week. I'm Samantha Donovan. Thanks for your company.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. COVID infections are on the rise again, thanks to the latest sub-variant of Omicron. And if you think just because you've had COVID already, you won't get it again, then think again. Today, epidemiologist Nancy Baxter on the health dangers associated with having COVID more than once and why we should do everything we can to avoid it. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.